Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. And our first guest today is Tad DeHaven. He's a freelance fiscal policy analyst, formerly at the Cato Institute. He wrote an article recently for National Review entitled War Between the Generations about the Social Security Nightmare. Welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, Phil. How you doing?
I'm doing great. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, well, my first question for you, sir, is, frankly, I want to know, is George W. Bush a socialist?
Is he a socialist? that's pretty harsh. I would say that currently the president is fond of using government to achieve his own ends. How about that?
And that's different from socialism, how?
again, I'm trying to be diplomatic here. It isn't very different, and to be rather obvious and rather blunt. In fact, it's been a very disappointing. Actually, the big question is right now is what's the difference between what we've had under Al Gore and what we've had under Bush? And the answer in terms of domestic policy is probably not much.
I think you're onto something there. In fact, I wonder, I hate to give any credit to Al Gore, but I wonder if it had been him, would we have a budget over $2 trillion now? Was it 2.7 or what is it?
2.4 we're up to, and that's and the damage isn't done, so I imagine it'll be a little bit higher after all said and done.
I mean, that's really incredible because Clinton had the first $1 trillion budget. So does that make George W. Bush twice as bad as Bill?
Well, you know, part of the problem here and what we're forgetting is that you know, the GOP came into office, took over Congress in 1994 with a lot of big-time promises, and that helped Clinton keep his budgets under control. But the problem is the Republicans got used to office, and all of a sudden those principles went out the door, and the main focus became how can we maintain power. So it's pretty much become Democrats light, although you can almost throw the light out anymore because they're pretty much just as bad.
But the problem with that is, I mean, I thought that conservatives don't want a bunch of pork barrel. Really, the best way to reinforce his base would be to show his base just how little money he's spent on them. Instead,
well,
it's like he's promising everything.
Conservatives say that, and part of the problem with Congress and part of the problem with the system, as a matter of fact, is one man's pork is another man's gold. So you can go to these different congressional districts and pull people, and they'll rant and rave about pork and irresponsible spending, but, you know, take away that million-dollar museum or walk away, and then they're up in arms. So, and that's getting to the problem with the Republicans, is they came in with the principles, you know, lower growth in government, and then after 8 or 9 years, they've just become the party of power, whereas they've been willing to spend whatever it takes to maintain their position.
Yeah, well, and that's true concerning the Republican Party as a whole, I suppose, but I don't think George Bush has ever mentioned the term downsized government or anything along those lines in a single speech ever, even when he was governor here in Texas.
Well, we've heard, I mean, he's used the standard phrases about limiting the growth of government and a more efficient government. I mean, you have to keep in mind this is the NBA president, and so I think his mentality is that we can reduce some of the ways to make government be more efficient, more accountable to the people, and in the view of people like me, you really can't make government more efficient. Government is inherently flawed. Government inherently doesn't work, and government is inferior to the private sector. And so you know, we're not really interested in trying to reform things or make it better. It's get rid of it, especially at a time of war. And you're trying to pass tax cuts and things like that, you just can't do everything. But something has to give, and that's the problem with this administration is they've been willing to let anything just give.
Well, and all these increases, I know somebody out there probably is saying, well, but that's the war on terrorism is the cost of all these giant things. Is that the case, or are his increases across the board?
No, they're across the board, and that's been the number one excuse from the administration is that, well, the money's been going to fight, you know, the war on terror and procure for the security of the United States, but that's really not true. I've calculated about 40% of the increase has gone to just regular old non-defense spending.
I'm sorry, what percent again?
About 40%.
About 40% has gone.
But here again, I want to make a key point is the government comes, you know, different politicians will give you a different definition of what defense spending is, what Homeland Security spending is. And oftentimes that can be manipulated to make it look like they're spending more on protecting the people, and that's not necessarily the case too. So it's sort of a ambiguous issue over you know clearly what is and what isn't Homeland Security. But let's make no mistake about it. The important thing is the money has not gone straight to defense or Homeland Security. Everybody's had their hand you know in the dish. Everybody's been taken care of, and at an exorbitant rate.
You mentioned the tax cut a minute ago, and passing tax cuts in a time of war. I think many people, I guess, especially on the right, well, first of all, on the left, they say, you know, tax cuts are terrible and irresponsible, and the government needs as much of our money as they can get. But then on the right, they complain that, oh, come on, that was just the meagerest of tax cuts. It didn't even really amount to anything at all.
Well, here's my problem with it. Now, it is true that the tax cuts were not particularly large, but at least they're a tax cut. My problem is, if you're going to cut taxes, then you need to hold a line on spending for the simple reason is, now, I'm not a big, in terms of a deficit, economically speaking, not that important. But to your moderate, middle-of-the-road Republicans, when you're holding a 51-49 majority in the Senate, they are important. They're politically important. So the problem you have now is, yes, we got these little tax cuts. They're fine, but they're not even permanent. And you're looking out 5 years down the road now in this massive spending spree we've sent the country on. Not only that, but Social Security and Medicare and the entitlement problem. The fact of the matter is, there's not going to be a lot of money to, A, keep the tax cuts we did get, but, B, have any further tax cuts or even some sort of tax reform or tax simplification. They've simply blown the opportunity to have this in the future. And I can't quite possibly see how we're going to advance any of these issues.
You say deficits are not important?
Economically speaking, no, they're not that important. No, they're not.
Well, I mean, they add up to this national debt that's over $7 trillion now. I mean, what are the interest payments on that every year?
Well, I mean, yeah, it's a waste of money. In my book, there's no doubt about it, it's a waste of money. But in terms of economic growth and things like that, you'll hear a lot of people on the left say that it crowds out private initiative and things and raises interest rates. And there's no statistical evidence of that whatsoever. I mean, we had the highest deficits in the 80s in terms of a percentage of the economy, percentage of GDP. And then we had the resultant boom in the 90s, so that's a little far-fetched. But what is important about the deficit is it shows that, you know, quite simply, we're taking in less money than we're putting out. And therefore, the deficit isn't so much the problem, but it's symptomatic of a larger problem, of a real problem, that is the government spending too much money.
Well, but the deficit every year is brand new money, right? That doesn't cause inflation and the devaluing of the dollar compared to foreign currencies and such?
There's no economic evidence of this. There's not. And to the degree that there is, it's negligible. It's not that important.
So for the national government to create $500 billion out of thin air, basically, in a year, that doesn't. I'm really surprised to hear you say that. I would have thought that has all kinds of effects. I mean, $500 billion is a lot of money.
Well, I mean, at the truest sense, I mean, any dollar that the government's spending because it's bringing in a dollar out of the taxpayer wallet, to me, is an inefficient. It's an efficiency loss because that's a dollar less being spent in the private sector. But in terms of this specific money, it's not that, you know, it's not that economically important. It's important in the sense that it could be better else put to use in the private sector than what the government's spending it. But still, historically speaking right now, these deficits as a percentage of GDP, you're only looking at like 4-5%. They're not, you know, they're not historic, in nominal terms, they're the largest in history, but in terms of as a percentage of the economy, they're not huge yet. But that's the whole key, is yet. And with the entitlement crisis coming up in about another decade when the baby boomers start to retire, these problems are only going to compound themselves. And that's why we need to get the fiscal house in order now to prepare for this.
Well, I want to put off the Social Security question for a minute here.
Okay.
The reason that in nominal terms, the deficits are the biggest ever, but in real terms, they're not, is because of the inflation that they cause, right?
Well, I don't know if they cause it.
The difference between the percentage of GDP that the deficit represented in, you know, pick a year in the 80s, 1985, 86, something like that, and now the reason that $7 trillion now is less than, or I'm sorry, $500 billion now is less than, $200 billion or whatever then, is because of all the inflation that's taken place since then, right? And if creating the new money that causes the inflation, what is it?
Well, these are, in terms of GDP, this is adjusted for inflation. But now the whole inflation issue, that's monetary policy. That's a whole different ballgame there.
Right. Okay. Now, really, I guess I ought to get to the article that you wrote in National Review about the Social Security nightmare. And as you just mentioned, the baby boomers are going to start retiring in the next few years now. And there's a lot of people who work for a check who see that Social Security has been deducted from their check every week, and they wonder if they're ever going to see it.
Well, and let's clear up a common misperception people have, including my own parents sometimes, is that when that money is deducted, okay, it doesn't go to an account in Washington, D.C. that has Phil's name on it and sits there and earns some sort of rate of return that Phil gets in about 30 years when he retires. Those taxes you pay on Social Security and Medicare, that money goes to current beneficiaries. And so the problem is, in the future, when you have all these baby boomers retiring, you have a smaller workforce to pay into the system to cover these benefits that these people are, quote-unquote, entitled to.
Well, what kind of ratio are we looking at, say, like at the height of the baby boomers retiring? How many working people per retired people do you think?
Oh, I don't have the numbers in front of me, and I don't even want to speculate on that. It's not pretty, one of the problems is birth rates are so low and are going to continue to be so low. And I know birth rates are supposed to be down to like 1 or 2%, which are all historic lows. I mean, we're barely even adding people at this point.
But it is true that you're going to have the fewest number of workers per retired people that we've had since Social Security was created, right?
Exactly. And I don't have that ratio offhand, but the bottom line is that you won't have enough people paying into the system to cover the beneficiaries.
Okay.
So the money has to come from somewhere.
Right, and you said that it's not sitting in a bank account with my name on it anywhere or anything like that. But
no.
I always hear on TV they talk about the Social Security Trust Fund.
It's an accounting gimmick. Yeah, there's no trust fund. It's an accounting gimmick. It means nothing.
It just goes into the trust fund and then straight into the general fund from there. It doesn't even stop.
Trust fund, general fund, it's an accounting gimmick. It means that, there really is no trust. I mean, if you open up the budget of the United States, it'll tell you right in there that these different terms they use and fly around are just accounting terms. They're basically meaningless. Fact of the matter is when the money comes out to go to the Social Security beneficiary, it comes from the Treasury just like every other dollar that's paid out. All goes into the same meat grinder and comes out the other side. Now, how they account for it, they can put pretty names on it like trust fund and general fund and stuff like that, but when all said and done, it's basically meaningless.
Well, so are we looking at a serious crisis here where people are going to stop getting their checks?
Well,
or somebody like me is going to have to pay so much in taxes to pay for somebody else's retirement that I can't even afford my own expenses?
Most likely what's going to happen is you're going to have either reduced benefits or you're going to have another increase in taxes or a combination of the two. And for us young folk, we're already getting a bad deal, and if whether you reduce the benefits or raise taxes, we're going to get an even worse deal. So it's the young people out there that are going to be on the end of a major screw job, because the older folks paid less into it, received their benefits, but as the system's gotten older, they've had to raise taxes to cover more people, and then like I said, in a few years here, when the baby boomers start retiring, that's going to require even more money that's not available. So they got to get it somewhere, And I think you know where it's going to come from. It's going to come from the workers.
Yeah, and you know, I've heard Dr. Paul say that the day where you open your mailbox and the retired person just doesn't get his check, that day will never come. They'll keep sending checks, but it'll just be in devalued money because they'll just have the printing presses on full speed. So people may not notice all at once that their benefits stop coming, just that check buys a smaller and smaller percentage of what they need.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Yeah, and the American people, and especially the younger generation, need to wake up. And the reason why the younger people are taken advantage of in this matter is because older people vote. They vote, and politicians are aware of that. That's why you had the Medicare prescription drug bill passed. Because George Bush and the GOP was counting on those votes for 2004. You know, the heck with the young people. Every single one of Bush's budgets in the past 4 years has talked about this looming entitlement crisis. Every single one of them. And in the 2000 election, Bush even said that we're going to start finally taking a look at possible privatization of accounts and things like that. Well, where's the beef? Nothing's happened. Instead, we get a Medicare prescription bill that's already unaffordable, and that within 3 months, 6 months, we already find out it's going to cost us an extra $130 billion.
Yeah, and then they talked all bad personally about the guy who leaked that truth out and basically did to his reputation what they did to the former Secretary of the Treasury and what they did to the former head of counterterrorism, which is attack them instead of the argument.
Well, yeah, I mean, Dick Clark aside and folks like that and Paul O'Neill aside, what they did to the Medicare fellow you're speaking of is an outrage. The vote on Medicare prescription bill was an outrage in Congress, where they purposely kept the vote open for hours, calling up and in one case making threats, and that refers to Congressman, I believe his name is Nick Smith, whose son is running for Congress. They threatened, the Republicans threatened to withhold campaign funds from him if he didn't vote yes on the bill.
Mm-hmm.
So for all the years of criticism about the Democrats and free spending and big spending and all that stuff, there's never been a round of spending like we've had under the Republicans. I hate to say it. And lest your interest or your listeners out there think that I'm some sort of Democrat liberal lover, it's quite the opposite. I'm just calling a spade a spade, and it's time for especially conservative-minded Republicans to not let themselves be taken for granted, because that's absolutely what the White House is doing here. This is Karl Rove's strategy, is that we'll toss in the tax cut, fight the war on terrorism, be aggressive, but we'll buy off everybody else. We'll buy off the elderly. We'll buy off the farmers. We'll buy off the education folks. And see, and if I've been up in the Hill and you talk to people and you say, well, are you still going to vote for Bush? And it's like, well, yeah, you know I am. And I say, don't you know you're being taken advantage of? And they say, well, yeah, we are. And see, that's the calculation. And you know what? It looks like it very well won't, you know, pay off. But is that what we want as conservatives? You know, that's the question every individual has to ask themselves.
Yeah, and you know, on that Medicare bill, the prescription drug thing, the opposition to these big government Republicans in the Congress, you mentioned them, you know, calling and threatening people and stuff and leaving the vote open all day to get it passed, and the opposition was against it because it wasn't enough.
Exactly, and that's your Democrats.
Oh, man. So, what's the solution then if somebody doesn't like $2.5 trillion budgets every year and they feel like they're being taken advantage of, or as you said, taken for granted by the Republicans? Who do they vote for?
Well, that's a very good question. And look, and I'll be honest with your listeners, I wrestle with this question back and forth every day. If you ask me 1 week, Norman, before I'll give you a different answer for the next week. Some days I want to vote for Bush just so that I make sure the French have a nasty morning on November 5th. But there's other days when I get so darn fed up, especially with the prescription drug bill, where I say, you know what, I'm not going to vote for him. I don't know if there is an answer, and I don't know what people should do, to be quite honest with you. And I hate to be so pessimistic, but I believe that come 15, 20, maybe even 30 years from now, it's going to take a serious crisis before people wake up. And that's basically what it takes. Sort of like 9/11. It takes a crisis. It takes a good hit between the eyes for people to wake up and realize that there's a problem, that some things need to be taken care of and fixed. Politicians are very short-term minded. They don't look at the long-term. The long-term doesn't benefit them. They're looking at every 2 years, in the case of senators, every 6 years, or the president, every 4 years. It's about getting reelected. It's about having power. That's one of the beautiful things about Ron Paul. You keep referring to Dr. Paul. You know, there's only a handful of guys in Congress who are true heroes and really principled folks, and Ron Paul is absolutely one of them. He should be a hero to every taxpayer in this country.
It's interesting, too, how many people from the left really like him, too, because even where they disagree with him, they know that he's honest, and they know that he says exactly what he means and is not thinking about, you know, little Karl Rove on his shoulder telling him what to say.
Exactly, and there's very, very few people like that.
Far too few. Well, so what about the Libertarian Party, then? Would you support the Libertarian candidate?
Who is the Libertarian candidate?
Well, I think they're going to decide in May. It's between a constitutional scholar named Mike Badnarik, who's here from Austin, and Gary Nolan, a former radio show host, and Aaron Russo, a Hollywood producer.
I mean,
but you know what they stand for. No question
right.
What they stand for.
Hey, in my personal belief, if you want to vote your principles, then go vote Libertarian. Will they win? No. But at least you could wake up the next day, and when you watch, Bush pass his 2000 or fiscal year 2006 mega-trillion-dollar budget, then at least you can say that you weren't part of the problem. You'll hear a lot of Republicans say, well, you know, don't vote for the Libertarian ticket because, you know, it's really a vote for John Kerry. But, hey, you know what? If you're tired of being taken advantage of and taken for granted, send a message. I very well may do the same thing. Of course, I live in Washington, D.C. I'm more concerned right now about the security issue. I might vote on that. I don't know what I'm going to do. But there's certainly nothing wrong with supporting an alternative. Unfortunately, it's going to take a groundswell of support from the people to make a serious fundamental change in the way the major two parties do business, especially the Republican Party, which has really gotten away from its fiscal conservative roots. All for the purpose of maintaining power, as I've said several times.
Well, and you know, honestly, we might be better off with Kerry because, as we discussed with the Medicare prescription drug thing, the Democrats, they love government so much that even when it's Republicans who they hate in power, still their only complaint is that their budgets are too small, that their bills don't go far enough. And so I figure, if we have a Democrat in the presidency, at least we can welcome back that, 20% of the population that consider themselves conservative and welcome them back to not trusting the state. You know,
well,
because here we are, we've had 4 years, three and a half years of all the Republicans love government now because George Bush is running it. Wouldn't you rather bring them back to sanity by having a Democrat in the White House?
That's an absolutely... great point, and a lot of folks are making that point here, especially in libertarian circles I run with, is in terms of domestic policy. If you have John Kerry as president, then it might be like going back to 1994 with Bill Clinton. You're gonna Republicans are gonna have a incentive to stymie the Kerry agenda. Although I'm concerned that the stymieing of the agenda might just give us Democrat light, because if you look at the last couple years of the Clinton administration, that's really when the fiscal train was beginning to rev up. Now it continued to fly on by with the first 3-4 years of the Bush administration, but after the first couple budget battles with Clinton, the Republicans in Congress signaled defeat and have pretty much rolled over every year since. So I'm not exactly sure that the situation would be like 1994 at all. And to be quite honest, it might not just matter. That's why the foreign policy concern is what a lot of people who are feeling taken for granted and who are frustrated might end up casting their vote on that.
Yeah, well, and I won't start up this argument at the very end of the interview about whether Bush's foreign policy is keeping anybody any safer or anything like that.
Right, right.
But We just don't have time to get into that one.
Right.
Well, Mr. David, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're up to, where people can read what you write, and so forth like that.
Well, I just actually got a website rolling now. Seems to today that everybody has their own website, but if you go to www.tompain.net, and that's TOMPAIN.net, you can see a list of all my writings, most of which all came from the Cato Institute. I've written from everything from ag policy to corporate welfare, to budget spending. I've even written on Sammy Sosa's Corp Bat, so there's a lot of information there. And
Have you taken a look at the Independent Institute? Do you know David Thoreau?
I know the Independent Institute. In fact, Ivan Elon, he was at Cato. He went over to the Independent Institute while I was at Cato to work on foreign policy.
Okay, well, maybe we'll see you around there sometime.
Hey, I'm always open and available. It's all about the cause, my friend. So I've tried to be a voice, you know, of help and reason for the past 4 years, but about the only thing I've accomplished is making some folks over at the White House not too happy. But that's okay.
Man,
we're going to
keep. That's a hell of an accomplishment, man. I wish I could say they cared about me.
Well, I can tell you one of the biggest honors of my life is when I published a op-ed critical of the Office of Budget and Management in the National Review, and they called up my boss to complain about it. So
at least we know
they're listening.
Yeah. All right, everybody, Tad DeHaven, he's a fiscal policy analyst, formerly at Cato, and you can look him up at tompain.org, you said, right?
.net.
Oh, .net, pardon me. All right, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Anytime, Phil, thank you.